Future-Proof Extra from Newstalk.
Now, in 2012, the Voyager 1 probe became the first man-made object to enter interstellar space, traveling further than anyone or anything in history. This is an astonishing feat, and one that took 35 years to achieve. But if we're ever to go beyond the reaches of the heliosphere, the environment of our sun, we can't really wait that long again. So how might we get there? Well, Jason Benkoski is a material scientist specializing in planetary research at Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab. He joins me now. Jason, welcome to the program. So let's first off talk about the way we get to faraway places first before we start talking about this nifty little idea, the solar thermal propulsion idea. So at the moment, we burn stuff to get off Earth. Why are we not using solar to electric energy to fuel rocket exploration once we get into space?
Well, you can to some extent. So there is one type of propulsion, which is ionic propulsion, which is a little bit different. I think it's different from all the other types because usually we always talk about heating up a gas and causing it to expand and using that to accelerate the gas. But here what you're actually doing is you're generating charged particles and you're using a voltage to accelerate it. And it's entirely electromagnetic. And there is one drawback, though. So you do have to recall, though, that you do need something to shoot out the back of the nozzle. So you can't just collect energy forever from the sun. You still need some mass, some propellant that you have to shoot out. Like there has to be something heavy.
Oh, I see. Because you need something to push against. Is that the idea? Because if you spin a turbine, there's no air for it to spin to push it. Is that the point? Because I was thinking, why don't you just use solar power to spin a turbine and the turbine would push you forward? But of course, without something to push against, that turbine won't work.
Yeah, I mean, the way the rockets work, it's the exhaust, the weight of the exhaust actually matters. I mean, it's the mass and the acceleration, 1/2 mv². So that's your energy that's going out the back. And that's what's getting you to go forward. So basically, your rocket is accelerating in one direction and your exhaust is accelerating in the opposite direction. Yeah. That has to cancel out.
Right. Okay. I never thought about that. So you need the atoms of the exhaust to push against to create that opposite. And that's why you need, and that's how you
that's
go forward.
It.
Okay.
That's it. There is one exception. One exception, though. You've heard of solar sails, right?
Yes.
Solar sails do not use any sort of mass. So they actually use the momentum created by photons. That is the one case where what you're talking about does actually work. So the photons of the sun, for example, would hit the solar sail and cause the spacecraft to accelerate. And there's no mass exchange. It's actually because photons actually have momentum. But you need a huge area in order to generate enough force for that to do anything.
And it takes a long time to speed up because of that. All right, so given all of that and knowing that we do need some sort of ejection to push against, this idea of solar thermal propulsion comes about. What exactly is it and how will it help us get beyond the pull of our sun?
Okay, well, the one aspect of it you have already hit on, which is that you're not carrying your energy with you. You're getting the energy all from the sun. And this is actually one of the easiest things to understand. I mean, if you think about rocket science, it's all this complicated stuff. But this one, I think every single day, if you have some leftovers in your refrigerator and you stick them in the microwave and you heat them up with the lid on, the lid pops off, right? Why does the lid pop off? You heat it up the gas. So the gas expands and that's what generates all your force. And all we're doing is asking the sun to heat up our gas to generate the force for us. So we don't have to carry that energy with us in the form of chemical bonds that then combust and generate the heat themselves. We're actually absorbing the heat from the sun. It causes the gas to expand, and that's where our force comes from. That's where our mechanical energy comes from. So we're going from light to heat, and then from heat to mechanical energy.
So the fuel doesn't need to combust at all. And does that make it much easier to bring more fuel because it doesn't need to combust?
In a way, yeah. The way to think about it is this. So we would actually use hydrogen gas rather than something like kerosene. So let's say you take like gasoline, right, and you burn it. Well, when you burn it, the stuff that comes off is carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, water. So those types of things are actually pretty heavy. If you think about the molecules themselves, they're heavy molecules. They have a mass of like 28 grams per mole. But if you use hydrogen gas, each one only has a mass of two, right? There's two atomic units there, so it's just two hydrogen atoms. So when you heat it up, the bang for your buck is that much bigger, because now those molecules expand to a much bigger volume than what you would get from these heavier carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide type things. And so that's what it really comes down to, and your density is lower as well. So you can put lots and lots of liquid hydrogen, whereas if you had done something like kerosene, you get much less.
Ah, okay. And so how hot does this probe need to be to get to the speeds we want to get to cut down the journey to beyond our solar system?
Right. Oh, man, the hotter the better. So that's the entire challenge of this method. The efficiency goes up with the square root of temperature without limit. So if you could get to 5,000 Kelvin, you would go to 5,000 Kelvin. So you're really just limited by what materials can survive those types of temperatures. So
Right. The
temperature that people talk about a lot is actually 3,000 Kelvin. 3,000 Kelvin would be a great spot because the specific impulse, which is how we measure efficiency, is 1,000 seconds. So that's the unit. Hydrazine, which is a very common system, that has a specific impulse of about 300 seconds. So you're already three times more efficient than a hydrazine rocket at that stage. So, I mean, most of the time when you're talking about rockets, you're happy if you get 20% improvement, but we're talking about 300%. And so if you can get to 3,000, you get that much. If you only go to 2,500, which is what we're targeting, then you're still around 900 seconds, and you're still almost triple at that point, and that's good enough.
So how do you get to 2,500 Kelvin?
You get really close to the sun. And for our maneuver, what's called the solar Oberth maneuver, it's tricky. So you actually fly out first to Jupiter. So you go to Jupiter first. That takes about a year. And you slingshot an unpowered slingshot around Jupiter. And you basically launch yourself straight into the sun. It's almost a free fall. You're going straight down into that energy well. And you don't fire your rocket until you're at the very closest point to the sun. So when you hit the bottom of the well, you're going to, all of your potential energy is now kinetic energy. You're traveling at 80 AU per year. So an astronomical unit is the distance from the Earth to the sun. So you're going 80 times that distance in a year. I mean, it's as fast as you can think about. That's when you fire your rocket, and that's how you do the Oberth maneuver. Because what happens with the rocket, you know, I talked about the exhaust is going one way, your spacecraft is going the other. Well, when you're not moving and you fire a rocket, all of the velocity is in the exhaust. If you look at a rocket when it first launches, you see the exhaust is going really fast, but the rocket is like hovering over the ground. So it turns out with the rocket, you get the biggest change in velocity if you fire the rocket when you're going faster. Because at that point, now the exhaust is kind of stationary, and it's your rocket that's going really fast. That's what you want, and that's what this whole project is about.
Okay, so I have a big question now. If you fire yourself at the sun and your end destination is not the sun, don't you increase the gravitational pull on your rocket or your spacecraft as you get closer to the sun? Would that not cancel out as you try to leave the orbit of the sun? If you're going really close, would the pull of the sun not reduce your ability to leave it significantly?
Well, there is a thing called the escape velocity. So if you're going fast enough, if you go really slow, you get almost like a circular orbit, right? And then the faster you go, it gets more and more elliptical. Well, there's eventually a critical velocity. If you exceed that, then you just basically slingshot and then you go out to infinity and you escape the gravitational pull of the sun.
So the idea is to go as fast as you can to skim the side of the sun, borrow some heat, presumably captured in some solar shield, and then use that to fire the propulsion of these hydrogen atoms that will then get you up to speeds you want to go. What sort of speeds are we talking about as you leave the sun for this rocket? What are the, have you done the maths on that?
Well, it's over 200,000 miles per hour. And for comparison, Voyager 1, if you remember, took 30 years to get outside the solar system. That's going about 1/6 as fast as what we're trying to do.
In terms of the engineering, do we have the materials to be able to protect a probe that can fly that close to the sun and still draw, because you've got to draw the temperature from the sun without melting everything. Because a shield is one thing, but drawing the heat in a safe way, that's a big challenge, right?
Oh, absolutely. So I work at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory, and we recently launched Parker Solar Probe. And Parker Solar Probe right now is in orbit around the sun at a distance of about 10 solar radii. And that's doing just fine. It has a heat shield on there. It has an alumina-based coating, which is kind of almost like a sapphire-type material. And then there's a carbon composite, just graphite, essentially forms the main structure of that heat shield. And then there are titanium rods that put some separation between the spacecraft and that carbon backing. And yeah, so the white coating reflects most of the sunlight, so that kind of keeps this front kind of cool. And then the carbon foam is sort of an insulator, so then the heat doesn't really travel through the foam that well. And then those standoffs from the titanium puts enough distance there where you're able to radiate a lot of that heat away and then protect the electronics. And so now for us, we want to go about one-fifth that distance. You know, we want to get down to 2.5 solar radii or 2 solar radii. So obviously our challenges are a lot bigger, because the thing you got to remember is that the energy that you're getting from the sun isn't linear with that distance. It's going as the square of that distance, right? So if you have the distance, you're quadrupling the heat that you got to get rid of.
Right.
And so it's a big challenge for us. But it turns out the materials exist. I mean, they've existed for a long time that have melting points above the range that we're talking about. So we're talking about carbon composites. They melt well over 3,000 Kelvin. The coatings, let's say zirconia is one that we're looking at, that melts at 2,800 Kelvin. And then tungsten, rhenium, those are all like 3,000 Kelvin type melting points and stuff. So things get up that high, no problem.
But in terms of getting that energy through the shield and into your rocket, is that an issue, or is that fairly easily understood?
Well, it's easily understood, but that was actually kind of the whole point of the approach. We realized that we were going to have a hard time getting rid of the heat, and that's how this idea was generated. When I first thought of this, I wasn't actually thinking about generating thrust. I was actually thinking about, how can I cool off this heat shield? And so I thought, oh, well, I'll just take a fluid. Maybe I'll just take some water, and I'll flow water through pipes that are embedded within the heat shield, right? Well, it turns out hydrogen is much, much better than water. Hydrogen absorbs 7 times more heat than steam. And we always think about water. You want to cool something off, you pour water on it. You want to cool off, you sweat, the water evaporates, you cool off that way. Hydrogen is 7 times better. And so if we absorb a lot of that heat that way, we're basically shooting it out the nozzle, and that prevents it from getting down to the spacecraft.
So you've got a twofer, essentially.
Yes. Yeah, I had no idea in the beginning that this was such an efficient way of propelling the spacecraft. I was only thinking about the thermals. I'm a materials engineer. All I cared about was making sure it didn't melt.
That sounds like a cool project to work on. Will it ever see testing? Is this something that NASA are currently considering for a project?
Oh, we're very early in that stage, of course, but we've only been running this project for a year and a half. So at this point, we don't have any immediate plans of doing a test. But I would say, though, you know, we talked a little bit earlier about the solar sail, and there is actually a project where they built a small satellite about the size of a loaf of bread, and they launched a solar sail, and they actually showed that it worked, and it was actually funded by private donors. It wasn't actually funded by NASA. I don't really know exactly how we actually end up testing our first prototype in space, but I would imagine it would be something along those lines. We probably would, instead of going towards the sun, maybe we would do low Earth orbit. We'd have a big solar concentrator, and we would test that way. I would say that that would be at least 3 years off or 4 years off from where we are today.
God, it's really, really interesting stuff. Thank you so much for taking us through with Jason Benkoski from the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab. Thanks very much, Jason.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.